This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
You're listening to this week's excerpt from the Dear Prudence podcast. To get the full-length members-only version every week, join Slate Plus at slate.com/prudypod.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence. Dear Prudence. Dear Prudy, do you think that I should contact him again?
Help.
Help.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Dear Prudence once again, and as always, I am your host, Dear Prudence, also known as Mallory Ortberg. With me in the studio this week is all-around delight and literal angel, Jolie Kerr. I'm so excited to have her on the show, but first, I want to thank everybody who wrote in response to the letter from the tired asexual a couple of weeks ago, who had a number of things that they were sort of struggling with. But one of the biggest ones was just, I'm sick of watching movies and reading books where it feels like romance and sex are the sort of like main themes and sort of crowd out any other type of relationship, you know. And I asked the good asexual and aromantic listeners of the show to write in with anything that they would recommend for this person. And y'all delivered. Like, you guys are on it. You are, like, coming out in support of one another. And it sounds like you read a lot. So just, like, hats off to all of you out there. I just wanted to read through a couple of the things that you guys sent in. I'm an aromantic asexual who is also super tired of we have to make two straight people kiss to sell seats, romance, and media. So I've recently turned to audio drama podcasts. It's been rare that I've listened to a podcast where romance was more important than personal growth or friendship. It was really affirming to get into audio drama as somebody who loves fiction but wasn't especially interested in hearing about other people kissing. There are seasons-long stories with no romance at all that have some of the best writing I've ever heard. Stories with asexual characters, plural, who are human beings who talk to each other, and even asexual protagonists. It might be weird to recommend a podcast on a podcast. Side note, listener, no, it's not. It's great. I'll totally read your recommendation. But Wolf359 has no romance and is about a group of people who become a beautiful space family. And it does an amazing job exploring themes of communication and what it means to be a person. The Bright Sessions does have romance in it, but also two explicitly asexual characters who talk to each other. And the protagonist of Ars Paradoxica is canonically asexual. Podcasts, none of them are straight. Then another person wrote in with like a list of some movies that had come out in recent years that they would recommend that either have no romantic elements or really minimal ones. So again, I can't, you know, add like the Dear Prudence endorsement having not seen all of these, but for whatever it's worth, you know, original letter writer, some other folks have enjoyed these. So some of the recommendations were Pacific Rim, Hot Fuzz, The Heat, Big Hero 6, the remake of Ghostbusters, Attack the Block, Secret of Kells, Now and Then, Stand By Me, Power Rangers, the 2017 movie, not the one that came out when I was in second grade, Death Proof, Guardians of the Galaxy, The Avengers, Pete's Dragon, either version. I didn't know there were two, so there you are. And The World's End. We're also going to add a bibliography and a filmography with this podcast when it comes out. So if any of you are listening and are like, that was too fast, I could not remember all of them, don't worry, you will be able to see this list in printed form. Some books that folks recommended were Beauty Queens by Libba Bray, Run by Cody Keplinger, We Are Okay by Nina LaCour, The Inexplicable Logic of My Life by Benjamin Alira Sands, Girls Made of Snow and Glass by Melissa Basherdust, Codename Verity by Elizabeth Wine, A Separate Piece by John Knowles, The Bone People by Carrie Hulme, Discworld, all of the Discworld books by Terry Pratchett, The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin. Last one is another recommendation of someone who said, I gotta throw in a plug for the ghost stories of M.R. James and the work of Edward Gorey, who described himself as probably asexual and has a wry, often dismissive view of romantic relationships. Also got to add Sherlock Holmes, Moby Dick, nonfiction adventure writing of the 19th century, like, for example, Endurance by Alfred Lansing, and a lot of classic sci-fi and fantasy, like War of the Worlds. They also recommended the new Star Trek movies and Harry Potter, where the non-platonic romance is a sideline that feels a little bit aside from the main plot. Mad Max Fury Road. They wanted to put another plug for Stand By Me, Local Hero, and then some recent fantasy films like Pan's Labyrinth and then Beasts of the Southern Wild. And somebody else said they were a little mad at me for forgetting to recommend American Vandal, which is a show that I love very, very much, and I totally forgot about, which is a like parody of true crime investigative shows about you know, which teenager drew a bunch of dicks on the cars of a faculty parking lot of a Southern California high school. So, you know, depending on your tolerance for, you know, the question repeated over and over again, who drew the dicks, that may or may not be something that appeals to you. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there. I hope that you find it. And thanks to everyone who wrote in with their recommendations. With that out of the way, I want to recommend Jolie Back. She is a cleaning expert, an advice columnist, and host of the podcast Ask a Clean Person. She's also the author of the New York Times bestselling book, My Boyfriend Barfed in My Handbag, and Other Things You Can't Ask Martha. Jolie, hello. Hi.
Hello, Mallory.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm so excited to be here. I'm excited to hear your voice.
I am too. I've been looking forward to this so much. I wish I could have found a Dear Prudence letter that also involved like a physical mess that somebody needed help cleaning up. But unfortunately, the only messes we deal with on this show are emotional.
Well, that's fine because I deal with a lot of physical messes on my show. So this is a nice little departure for me in a way.
By the end of this episode, listeners will be clean in both body and mind. We will just purify ourselves and one another, and we'll just have like perfectly made beds and, you know, tidy kitchens and neatly ordered emotional lives.
I hope so.
I don't think that's what
too
I
much
want
to promise,
everybody. Right? Like,
no, I don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah. So
and it's truly what I want for everyone.
Yes. Especially, I feel like almost every episode that I've done now in the last couple of months has started with a letter about sisters, which I'm starting to realize now might be a pattern. I don't know why I seem to be picking like sisterly drama to start every podcast with, but I think it's become a pattern. So I hope that you are like ready to, you know, help some sisters out with one another. But I got to look for more brothers who are fighting. Where are all the fighting brothers?
Maybe they're just fighting in the more literal sense of fighting, like wrestling each other. And that doesn't require writing letters to advice columnists.
You know, I do occasionally.
They might be writing to me to ask how to clean blood up.
Oh my gosh. I do occasionally get a letter that's like, and this ended in a fist fight. What do we do now? And I'm like, I wish you had written sooner. But yeah, this first one is about some sisters. Would you be so good as to read it for us?
I sure will. The subject is sisterly anxiety. Dear Prudence, I'm worried about my 18-year-old sister. For the past year, she has been dating someone with alcohol and mental health issues. He drinks constantly, and she calls me crying about the many plans he's canceled. He once drove for over an hour to see her for her birthday and got out of the car too drunk to stand. More concerning is that he has told her that he has persistent, uncontrolled thoughts about hurting her. He has hinted that the thoughts manifest as voices in his head, but he is unwilling to seek treatment for fear of receiving a diagnosis of schizophrenia. It runs in his family. He also uses these thoughts to justify his drinking, saying that he has to suppress them somehow. He has not hurt her physically in the past, but I am worried for her. She told me that she thinks he might be dangerous, but she's committed to helping him and encourage him to work on getting better. I admire her understanding, but I can't stop thinking about her safety when she is with him. As her older sister, I've always made a point to check in with her about her relationships, offering her a place to talk. And I've tried to gently guide her towards asserting herself in her romantic partnerships, but generally I think she should be able to make her own mistakes and learn from them. However, in this case, I feel stuck and scared. When we talk, she is able to make plans to draw boundaries and to reach out to others for support, but she never follows through. Is there anything I can do to help her stay safe?
Woof.
Yeah, I had a similar reaction when I read this.
It's just, I feel the worry. Like, I'm worried.
I'm worried, too. This sounds like a very, very scary situation on a lot of levels, including and especially that this is a that her partner is someone who is regularly getting behind the wheel of a car drunk. And that's terrifying. I in my own personal life have been deeply affected by drunk driving. It's a very concrete thing that I think she can begin to seize on in talking to her partner. But there's so much else that's scary here.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's so clear that both the letter writer and their sister want to help him, want to support him, are aware of the ways in which, like, somebody suffering from a possibly untreated mental illness needs help and support, not simply like rejection and condemnation. I feel like they have that covered. So, you know, I just want to kind of emphasize, don't let the compassion and empathy that you feel for him keep you from drawing boundaries or saying, if you cannot commit to not doing this thing, then I cannot be around you. And I think the constantly driving drunk and the fact that he has told her he thinks about hurting her, those are the two most important things here, right? Like,
absolutely.
That's what needs to be addressed. Like, he absolutely deserves and needs treatment both for his alcoholism and for the uncontrolled, unwanted, intrusive thoughts about harming others. But in terms of what you and your sister need to focus on, those are the two things. He could kill himself. He could kill other people. He could kill you. And I don't want to say that as if to say, like, you know, he's about to do that. But these are very real red flags.
Absolutely. 110%. I agree with that. And that those are very concrete things to begin to address with him when she finds the strength to start to do that. It sounds like she's scared to even open the conversations, that she knows she has to. And whether that's partly out of actual fear of him, which is obviously valid given the situation, or also just fear of confronting a difficult situation or having a difficult conversation. You know, she has every right to be scared, and her sister has a right to be scared too. One thing that struck me about both of these sisters is that, in a way, they're handling kind of similar things, in that they want to help someone they love, but you can't control another person's behavior. So the sister who's worried wants the sister in the volatile relationship to make changes, and the sister in the volatile relationship wants her partner to make changes.
Right.
But you can't control someone else's actions.
Right. I totally, yeah, I'm right there with you, I think. And it's also hard when it sounds like what the younger sister is saying is like, I do think he might be dangerous, but I want to help him. And helping someone does not necessarily mean staying in a relationship with them or being around them when they say things like, sometimes I think about hurting you, or when you see them get out of a car and they can no longer stand. And I understand that, you know, the letter writer is not going to be able to say you need to break up with him. But I do think it's really important for the letter writer to stress, you can call me if you feel unsafe when you are around him. Like, you know, to look into, like, are there, like, women's resource centers, like, in the town that you live in? Are there, like, numbers that she has in her phone that she can call if he is in a crisis and she doesn't know how to handle it because she's not a mental health professional or a paramedic, you know, if he's, like, unable to stand? So to find and put her in touch with multiple resources and to talk through what do you need if in a moment he talks about hurting you or he is drinking and driving? Like what's something that we can get you in touch with that's not just, I don't know what to do?
Right. Absolutely. And I like the idea of arming her with resources before a crisis happens, so that when she's in the crisis, she has a resource to call without having to figure out who to call.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, plan ahead. You know that this is going on for him. I'm going to put in a plug right now for Al-Anon for both of you. Because if Al-Anon is, like, not an organization that you're comfortable with, just in the sense of, like, having a spiritual component, there are numerous secular alternatives to Al-Anon. And you can also absolutely work an Al-Anon program without having any sort of, like supernatural spiritual outlook. But if nothing else, you will be around other people who know what this is like to love somebody who is kind of in a state of emergency a lot of the time, and who can help you figure out what are ways that you can take care of yourself so that your life does not become a constant emergency. I'm interested in hearing what you think, because you talked about kind of having a personal experience with drunk driving. I'm just very aware, like, I am reluctant to advise listeners or readers of the column to call the police, especially when there's a case like this of somebody with an untreated mental illness, because often, you know, bringing the police in does not always de-escalate a situation, can
right.
often lead to more violence. But, you know, I'm also aware that, like, drunk driving kills people, and it's
yeah.
incredibly dangerous. Do you have a sense of, like, do you feel like this would be a situation where you would say that needs to at least be one of the options that's on the table?
I certainly think if you are aware of an incapacitated driver, you have, I don't, obligation is such a hard word, and I agree with you about the risks of bringing in the police, but the reality is that driving drunk is a crime. It's a crime that puts a tremendous number of people at risk, and I think you have to take that so seriously. I you know, as I said, it's been a part of my life. I would never want anyone else to go through what I went through because someone I love got behind the wheel of a car drunk.
Right. And, you know, for an hour, too drunk to stand. That's
terrifying. You
know, the number of accidents he could have gotten into during that drive is tremendous.
It's terrifying.
And I think one of the things that might be helpful again here is to talk through, like, for you, letter writer, if you feel like, hey, if I see him and I know he's about to get behind the wheel, or if he's just gotten out of the car and he fell out, if for you, you're like, that's the line I have to draw. That's where other people's safety takes priority. I would call the police in that situation. I think that's good to think about in advance. Like, what are situations where you would and would not do that? And to talk about that ahead of time. To, again, encourage your sister, like, when you're there in those moments, you know, what do you feel like your options are? You know, you know, is there something that he could do where you would say, I love you and you need to go get help and I cannot do that for you, so I have to set a boundary? Like, is there anything he would do that would make you say, I need to leave, even if it's just for the night, even if it's just for the day? Like, obviously, the best advice that I could give is, I think your sister should end her romantic relationship with this guy, encourage him to seek treatment, and to say, I cannot do that for you. I cannot do that, while we are enmeshed with one another. But I also know, just as the letter writer can't make their sister break up with this guy, I can't either. So that's my number one advice, is encourage her to end the relationship.
Yeah, that I think that ending the relationship is the ideal outcome, but of course you can't make someone do that.
Right. And there's, I think, also that sense of, I love him, so I can't break up with him. And then also that fear of, if I broke up with him, would I not be contributing to the further, like, stigmatization of people possibly suffering from, intrusive thoughts I don't think schizophrenia is, like, any longer the accepted term, but I don't know off the top of my head, what, like, names are used for that particular diagnosis. And I just want to say, that's not the same thing. Like, choosing to end a relationship because someone is regularly drinking and driving and has talked about harming you is not the same thing as, turning your back on somebody who needs help. That's setting a healthy, appropriate boundary that prioritizes your own safety. And
absolutely.
It doesn't mean you're consigning him to, like, being abandoned and full of despair, or that you're saying he is unlovable. That is taking care of yourself. So I think, number one, that's what you should encourage your sister to do. But then to also say, if you are not ready to do that today, I still love you. I support you. I'm going to be here and I'm going to help you, so that she doesn't feel like, look, you either break up with him, or I will no longer be around, because that would put her, I think, in a worse position. So
I agree. One concrete thing I was going to suggest for the sister who's concerned, is to say all of that, not in a way that is laying down directives or issuing ultimatums for her sister's behavior or choices. But to say it clearly, but also to be really present in terms of checking in, and not checking in, you know, every day to say, what has he done today? Just to be there so that you have some comfort for yourself, that at least on a regular basis, getting a text message from her or an email from her or something that tells you, for your own comfort, older sister, that younger sister is okay, at least today. And of course, tomorrow could bring something new. And it doesn't have to be a daily check-in, but but just that regular, consistent communication so that you are comforted that she is okay.
Yep. And I'll just say one thing that kind of leaps out at me here in this letter. Two things. One is I admire her understanding. And I want to redirect that. I don't think that what we're talking about is understanding. I think what we're talking about is panic and enabling. And I'm not saying that because your sister's a bad person. She's terrified and she loves him and she wants to believe that it's going to get better. But that's not understanding. That's not compassion. Because he has said, I have these thoughts that, you know, at least periodically, I think about harming you. I drink in order to not have those thoughts. But when I drink, I commit harmful actions like driving completely wasted. And I'm not willing to seek, you know, medical treatment because I'm afraid I'll get diagnosed with something I already believe that I have. So when your sister says she's encouraging to help him work on getting better, what I see is he is actively avoiding getting better. He is avoiding the very treatment that could possibly help. So,
the younger sister is enabling that choice.
Yes, that's not understanding. So let's call it what it is. And again, you don't have to say that harshly or say that she's like an enabler or a bad person. But to just say, here's what I see from you, which is that he is actively avoiding treatment and drinking in order to manage his symptoms. To me, that looks like he is not working to get better. What do you think is happening here? Like, how do you see this getting better? And not like putting her on the spot and grilling her, but kind of gently encouraging her to like play that tape through. Like, how is this going to get better if right now his plan is I drink when these thoughts come up and I don't go to the doctor and I don't seek professional mental help? So, you know, you already have had some of the conversations that we encourage. Like, we plan on drawing boundaries. We plan on reaching out and then she doesn't do it. Like, ask her about that. Say like, you know, I say this out of love. I say this out of concern. We talk about plans and then you don't do them. Do you have a sense of why that is? Like, what happens in the moment? Do you feel embarrassed? Do you kind of get so anxious about fixing the crisis in front of you that you kind of forget? Would it help to write it down? Like, what's the missing element here that's keeping this from happening? You know, have those conversations because it may be that she just kind of needs help realizing like, ah, I am not actually helping. I am doing the same thing over and over again and hoping that things change. And again, this conversation may not immediately result in change, but it will be good to have that conversation. And then I think just for both of you, and you can't make her go to Al-Anon, but you can certainly find a meeting for yourself and go. And just if nothing else, talk to other people who have been through something similar and can offer you emotional support. And I think most importantly, to really think through for yourself, if I see or hear about him driving drunk, will I call the police? And if so, I need to know that ahead of time, you know, and, you know, that's a big thing to do. But I also, you know, what you described, driving an hour, falling out of the car, people can die. And that, I think, is the most important thing. Your sister could die. Again, I don't, like, you just, this is serious. Like, I don't know what your relationship's like with your parents. I don't want you to say, like, immediately go, like, tell the personal details of her private life to anybody and anybody else. But this is not something to sit and wait on, you know, like this is the kind of thing where, you know, if you heard, and I hate to like do like a big scary thing, but like if you heard tomorrow that he had killed her, you would think he said he was going to hurt her. And gosh, I apologize. I feel like that makes it sound like if you don't immediately put him behind bars, you are responsible for her future death. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying you do have really clear, actionable evidence that he needs help he is not getting and he is not trying to get.
Right. And that he is in danger. The sister's in danger.
Strangers are in danger.
And other people are in danger because he's getting behind the wheel of a car, fall down drunk.
Yeah. And yeah, you know, like there are things like, you know, involuntary psychiatric holds, which again, like, I sure don't love recommending those things. Like those are not perfect solutions. They don't fix underlying issues, but that needs to be something that you investigate and consider and talk about with other people in your life and think through, is this something that I think might be necessary? How would I go about doing it so that you're not waiting until she calls you crying and saying, you know, we're in a car, he's driving, he's been drinking, he says that he, you know, is thinking about hurting me. What do I do? Again, I'm just really mindful of, I'm like kind of imagining worst case scenarios, but I want you to have all the tools available at your disposal. I want you to have good plans of action. You know, if you're not seeing a therapist right now, it might be really helpful to talk through this with somebody who could help you find other resources that are available both for him and for her and for yourself. Mm-hmm. And I'm just really sorry. This is a lot to be going through at 18.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you're taking it seriously. Keep taking it seriously. Take it really seriously. This is not just like with some love.
This isn't just a crummy boyfriend.
Right. Right. This is an issue of safety.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Would you please read this one?
I sure will. The subject is Relentlessly Friendly Neighbor. Dear Prudence, we've lived in our neighborhood for 4 years, and since the day we moved in, our neighbor has been trying to forge a friendship with us. I can't stand being around her for more than 15 minutes. She's not a bad person, but she's loud, pushy, and opinionated. We've attended cookouts at her house and have invited her to similar neighborly gatherings at ours out of politeness. But I've been avoiding invitations to get our nails done or see a movie one-on-one. That day won't work for us. I'm so busy work right now. The moon is in the wrong phase that night. If anyone had avoided me for this long, I'd have left them alone long ago. Yet here we are, 4 years in, and just this week she suggested a date night for me and my partner with her and her husband. What kind of recourse do we have here? The daily dance of avoidance is tiresome. Is this a suck it up or move situation? I can't imagine a delicate but direct way to tell someone that you're just not interested in spending quality time with them, but I'm open to suggestions.
Oh, man. I gotta say, I really admire, which is maybe not the best work, the best word, the degree to which people will write letters, not just about boyfriends, but just anyone, and they will say, this person's not bad. And then they will describe 5 bad things.
I was gonna say the exact same thing. I was like, no, she is... bad. I mean, yeah. She's not like serial killer bad, but she's
sure.
Pushy and loud and opinionated. Well, I guess I'm all those things too, and I'm.
But it doesn't sound like in this way, right? Like,
no.
Yeah, it's okay to give yourself permission to say I don't like her. You don't have to sort of like I'm sure she's fine. Like, yes, it's clear that you are not like consigning her to the ash bin of history, but you don't like her. You don't think she's a good person and you don't want to be around her. So don't, I think part of what's holding you back is this sense of she has not sufficiently committed enough atrocities that I would feel justified in saying like, I have to go, Marion, stop talking to me. Right. Which
right.
I think sometimes we can get where we feel like unless someone does something beyond the pale, I can't set a boundary. So I have to keep like re-explaining why they're not bad enough for me to be like rude to. Yeah, it's rough when somebody does not respond to cues the way that we ourselves would. Certainly, I think it is unusual that she has failed to pick up on like, you know, oh, sorry, the moon exploded last night, so I can't come look at art with you or whatever. Like, that's rough that she hasn't picked up on that. But that means you have to step it up, right? Like,
yeah.
That means, again,
yeah.
You don't have to like throw stuff in her lawn, but just start cutting the conversation short. Don't wait for her to stop talking and look for an out. That's not going to work with her. Say things like, I have to go. I can't do that. I'm not available. No. Not excuses. Just, no, I can't do that. I'll see you. Like, go with like, no, I can't do that. Goodbye. And say it nicely.
Yep, that was exactly what I was going to say. You have to stop saying like, no, I'm sorry. I have plans at night. It has to just be no, thank you.
Yep. And just keep it moving. So say like, no, yeah. I can't. And if she tries to draw you into something, she's like, I have to go. Bye.
Yeah.
You know, escalate your rudeness because I have to go by is barely rude. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You are still well within the rights of like, and if she tries to like, oh gosh, I'm so surprised or like, what's going on? You don't have to engage with that. Just continue to say things like, I don't have time. I have to go. Goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
Say it all the time. And even if she doesn't get the hint, you can say those things and leave. So she can go deal with her feelings elsewhere. And you don't have to worry about it. Don't let her, like if her face falls or if she says, wait, explain this to me. You don't have to do a thing about that.
Yeah. That was exactly what I was going to say. I don't think I have anything else constructive to add to it. I think you just got to say no.
Yeah, just move on, which we're going to do right now.
And exactly. Like,
Keep it moving. Yeah. Don't be delicate. Just don't be a bitch, you know?
Like, right. No, because you don't, you know, the last thing you want is an infuriated neighbor, because that can escalate.
But like,
then you're Rand Paul and you're getting, you know, not knocked off your riding lawnmower.
Not here. Yeah. Be direct. Don't be a jerk. Like, don't say like, and fuck you. That's all you need to do to stay not rude is just, I don't have time for this conversation. I have to go. No, I can't make it. Goodbye. Say those things. Say them in a slightly nicer tone than I just said it. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, our last letter.
Oh, this is the one that I have thoughts about.
Well, you know, you see the subject line and you're like, well, based on what I remember from this particular reference, that's not a good way to be feeling. So the subject is just, feel like Pepe Le Pew. Dear Prudence, my wife and I have been married for 35 glorious years. We are both 65. Our marriage is strong. We have always had great sex until last year. In January, she decided she did not want to have sex anymore. She really did not state this as a firm decision, but she has since rebuffed my many attempts over the past 12 months to start anything. I thought the problem could be physical, researched menopause, and purchased some interesting products for her to try out. So far, though, those products are sitting unopened by the bed. I have tried my old standby, never fail moves, and she tells me she is too tired, or it's too late, or too early, or her neck hurts. We've had discussions about this, and she just laughs it off. The problem, though, is that I don't see the humor in the situation. I have mentioned that given her reluctance and my eagerness that maybe we should involve a counselor, but she rejects that idea, too. I am getting desperate. Any ideas? Do you have any ideas?
I have many ideas. First of all, I want to say that there are a lot of things about this man that I really like. And I want to preface the next few things that I'm going to say by starting with that, because I don't want it to sound like I'm just coming down on him with a sledgehammer. I think that he is handling a difficult situation quite well and with good intent and with kindness and love. But I think he has mishandled the situation, and I think he has overlooked something that to me seems so obvious, which is that I think, sir, that your wife is having an affair. Oh, I got a gasp out of you, Mal.
I did not see that coming. I thought something totally different.
What did you think?
I thought she's just done having sex. She's 65. They've been married for 35 years. I'm not saying, by the way, that everyone...
Mallory, that's not the way the libido works.
...is done. But I thought she...
No.
She just is done. She's wrapped up. She had 35 years and her sex drive is like winding down. Could be wrong.
Nope.
Could be an affair.
Nope. I don't think that's what's happening.
Okay.
And the thing is that if it were... So now I'll get into some nitty gritty things that I want to say to this guy. I know you really, really mean well, but you have wildly missed the mark on so many things here, my friend. And we got to set you a little bit straight. First of all, at age 65, the symptoms of menopause aren't going to suddenly be affecting your marital relations.
Oh, by the way, as soon as I saw that, I was like, wait a minute, what's the average age of menopause? And I looked it up. It's 51.
Like, it's 51.
Your wife is well past menopause. She did not just enter menopause.
Exactly. And there are many, many symptoms. And there is a wide range of, even within those symptoms, how they affect certain women. Some women do experience a real decrease in libido. Some experience a small decrease. It can fluctuate throughout the course of menopause. Just because menopause happens at 51 doesn't mean that the effects of menopause aren't felt at 65. Certainly, many of the physical effects like vaginal dryness or loss of libido are things that will continue on into you know your twilight years, if we will.
Right. Yeah. I'm sorry, too. I don't want to make it sound like I'm just like, obviously, she's just done having sex, as happens to everyone when they turn 65. I just wanted to throw that out there as a possibility, because it sounds like that might be where she is coming from. But thank you for saying
that. Right. And it sure is. It just seems to me that all of a sudden, unless she had menopause very, very late, And the loss of libido isn't that abrupt. I mean, it can be, of course, but it just seems to me that the timeline isn't really adding up. And then I want to point out a couple other things that he did that, again, with great intentions, and I admire his bravery in confronting the situation, because really it does take a tremendous amount of bravery to do the things that he's been doing, to have these conversations, to research this on his own. But
see,
going
I don't
out
think they've been having conversations. I think they had one, and then she's kind of laughed stuff off. And instead of saying, like, hey, this feels really serious to me, I need to talk to you about this, he was like, I'm going to go do my own research, I'm going to buy toys, but I'm not going to, like, really, like, kind of insist on a frank conversation of, like, do you see our sex life as having a future? And if you're done, you know, why is that? And how are we going to renegotiate the terms of our marriage? It feels like they kind of had the conversation, and then he sort of, like, went off into a panic on his own.
I kind of read it maybe a little differently. He said, you know, we've had discussions about it. And then he mentions that he had suggested a counselor. So it sounded to me like this is a thing that they've talked about more than, you know, more than one or two times at least. And maybe I'm wrong about that. The going out and purchasing the products, I wish he had been a little bit more specific about the products that he had purchased. Because
I'm assuming just like vibrators.
One, I'm curious.
I don't know. Yeah, maybe it's like banana stuff. Maybe it's like a sex car.
I assume it's probably not banana stuff. I assume it's probably some sex toys and probably some lube. And, you know, because he said he was doing his research about menopause. And, you know, again, vaginal dryness is one big symptom. So certainly, you know, personal lubricant and stimulating creams and those kinds of things would sound like probably about what he purchased. And I on the one hand, I love that he did all this research and he went out and he bought these things, but also he bought them without involving her in it. And so of course they're sitting unused. She might not have any interest in the things he bought her because he didn't involve her in it.
Right. If I tell someone I don't want to have sex anymore and they say later, even if it's really well-intentioned, hey, I bought you some sex toys, I feel like you did not listen.
Absolutely.
And again, it's well-intentioned, but like I can see why that didn't work. That was not an effective strategy. I think the best strategy is to like have conversations and if real ones, not just like bring it up and then let her laugh it off. And obviously you can't force someone to like share what they're thinking and feeling, but she's been your wife for 35, as you say, glorious years. Like really say like, I take this really seriously. I want to know more about what's going on with you. This is like a really big change in our marriage after 35 years. And I don't understand why. And it doesn't seem like this feels like a problem for you. And I just want you to know, like, I feel rejected and confused and like, I don't know what you're thinking. Can we talk about that?
And it is a problem for me. I mean, I think he needs to clearly state this is a problem for me.
Right.
Sex is a part of a romantic relationship, whether that's a marriage or a partnership. It doesn't have to be, but certainly it's an expectation. And if one partner is going to take that out of the equation, it needs to be addressed in some way. It needs to be squared with the other partner, and there needs to be some solution to it. Whether that's, I mean, I don't know that we need to go so far as to say, you know, run right into an open marriage or pick up a mistress or something like that. But I mean, maybe that is the agreement that they come to, that she, you may be right. She may just say, I'm done. Like I've done you for 35 years and I'm done doing you. And in which case, then, I mean, he's not entitled to sex, but
they're entitled to talk about it. And he's entitled to have his feelings about it. I think one of the things that's always hard about stuff like this is like, we always kind of want to say like a sex life is really important to like your happiness and well-being. And of course, if something's not working, you should talk about your other options. But I also want to just acknowledge like there's not always a fix for everybody. And there's not, and that doesn't mean there's not more you can do, but there's not always going to be like, I can guarantee you either your wife's going to give you a really satisfactory explanation. You guys can fix whatever discrepancy there is between your current sex drives, or you will be able to open up your marriage and like at 65, after 35 years of marriage, just roll into that super casually, feel great about it, and meet somebody who also wants to have sex with you. Like that. there's no guarantee that you will find a mistress or that an open marriage will work. I think the most important thing for the letter writer to say to his wife is this. About a year ago, you didn't say this firmly, but you said something along the lines of, I don't want to have sex anymore. And I don't know why you said that. I don't know where you're coming from. And since then, when I have attempted to reestablish sexual intimacy between us, you've told me, you know, that you're tired or it's too late or it's too early or your neck hurts. And that did not used to be the case every time I tried to have sex with you over a year-long period. I think there's something else here. I would love to know what that is. Will you please share that with me? I think that's the question to ask, is like there's some information here that you're holding back, either because you think I won't want to hear it.
Because you're having an affair.
Or because you're having an affair. You know, and ask, like, are you having an affair? Like, put that out there on the table. Ask.
Yeah, I think you got to ask. I mean, honest to God, I think you got to ask.
Yeah, like ask, are you having an affair? Do you not want to have sex anymore? And were you kind of hoping I would just not notice? Because I got to tell you, I've noticed and I think about it a lot. And I would rather have the painful conversation if it turns out we both want really different things or you feel about something differently than I do. I would rather know that because I love you and I want to know you than to have to guess on my own. So that's, I think, the way that you got to play this one is just point those things out and ask that question and say, like, and please don't laugh this off because it's painful to me. And hopefully she can kind of see that. You guys can have a real conversation and let us know if you do. If you do, and let us know what you guys think might be going on and how that is able to move ahead. But you gotta find out.
God, please let us know.
Not gonna be the solution.
Please let us know because I'm gonna lose sleep wondering if this lady's having an affair. I think I've completely convinced myself that she is.
I'm gonna lose sleep trying to think of your roller derby name.
Okay, I like that. I bet you're gonna come up
because it's gonna have to have something to do. It's gonna have to have like some sort of cleaning pun, in it.
Obviously, but obviously, it's like my Real Housewives tagline.
Go on,
which is I might be a clean person, but that doesn't mean I won't fight dirty.
Oh my God!
I know, is that so good?
Oh, you would have to open every what do they call it when you play a game of roller derby? Like you'd have to open every like tournament or whatever with that line.
Yeah.
God, or like, and then you're like the thing that you toss off before commercial is like, I'm going to wipe the floor with you.
Oh, God. Oh, Mallory, that's so good.
There's
you're
also
so got to
be
fly.
Something about like moving swiftly and using a Swiffer, Taylor Swiffer. I don't know. We're going to keep working on this.
Taylor Swiffer. Oh, my God.
We're going to make something happen and it's going to be
the
incredible.
Irony that I love Taylor Swift, but I hate Swiffers is perfect.
I should
one.
Have known actually that you would have a really strong opinion about like the kind of stuff people buy to avoid owning like a mop.
Yes, I sure do. I sure do.
Are you pro mop? Do you endorse mops or is there a better way of like wet cleaning the floor?
Oh God.
Sorry,
you're
going to
kill
know
me
I'm
for
like,
this. It's going to be the end of our friendship. You're going to be like, Joel, you're bringing me down.
No, I'm here for it.
I actually do not love mops, but before I say what I like recommend for people, I want to say that there is definitely a place for mops in this world. And there are some very good mops. So I'm not completely virulently anti-mop, but I'm a proponent of washing the floors on your hands and knees. And I even call it handsies and kneesies. I have a cute little name for it. It sounds like
handsies
the most horrible.
And kneesies.
Handsies and kneesies. It
I
sounds like
you.
The most horrible. I know you do.
I love you.
It sounds like the most horrible chore in the world, but actually when you try it one time, you realize like, oh, it's actually not quite as bad as I thought it was going to be. And it gets the floors so clean and it's so satisfying. And then there's dirty wash water and you can take a picture and you can tweet it at me and I will share it on my Twitter timeline every Wednesday for Wash Water Wednesday. Because the weirdest thing, not even
so
the weirdest thing, but
weird.
One of...
I love the ways in which you are weird. The world needs
one of the weirdest things about this job is that people every single week do send me photos of their dirty wash water from doing the floors, from washing their bras, from cleaning their hockey gear. Hockey water is my favorite water in all the lands and all the seas. And they take these pictures and they tweet them at me and then I share them every Wednesday with the hashtag Wash Water Wednesday. And it's a thing now. Like it's a big thing.
Oh my God. Bless you and keep you. And I just hope your brand continues to flourish and you get all
Thank
the pictures
you.
Of dirty water that you want for the rest of your life.
Thank you, my friends.
Thank you so much for coming on the show and for inspiring me to go home and tidy my own house, which is actually pretty clean right now. I feel good.
Oh, good. I like to hear that.
You know, I'm keeping it reasonably clean these days. So
good. Yeah. I'm glad for you. I want people to live exactly how they want to live, because it also doesn't, and I don't mean this in a mean way, but it impact on my life how other people keep their home.
Right.
And the dirtier you all are, the more work I have. So that's great too. But I'm glad if it makes your life better, I'm really glad that you're doing that for yourself.
Yep. All right. Get out of here, lady. Thank you so much. This was fabulous.
Thank you. Mal, this was fun.
Bye for now. Thanks for listening to Dear Prudence. Our producer is Max Jacobs. Our theme music was composed by Robin Hilton. Don't miss an episode of the show. Head to slate.com/dearprudence to subscribe. And remember, you can always hear more Prudence by joining Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/plus to sign up. If you want me to answer your question, call me and leave a message at 401-371-DEAR, that's 3327, and you might hear your answer on an episode of the show. You don't have to use your real name or location, and at your request, we can even alter the sound of your voice. Keep it short, 30 seconds, a minute tops. Thanks for listening.